Welcome to the conference room with this week's guest, Brandon Connolly.
If you have enough opportunities in the pipeline that are at, you know, mature enough stages, then in spite of the chaos, you're still going to get there. So it's just overweighting on higher probability opportunities and assuming that X percent of them are going to close.
Welcome to The Conference Room, a weekly podcast where business leaders and growth experts kindly share their experiences, actionable tips, and secrets to successfully grow a business. If you like the podcast, don't forget to subscribe and leave us a five-star review. It'll really help us out. And I really hope you enjoy this week's episode. I'm Simon Lader. Welcome to The Conference Room. Good afternoon and welcome to The Conference Room. I'm joined by Brandon Connolly. Brandon is a sales leader with a 25-year plus career in driving growth in early stage and multinational technology businesses. He spent 7 years with Avantail, who were then acquired by SonicWall, and then a further 5 years with SonicWall. He then joined Zemprise, who were acquired by Citrix, and then ran Citrix's mobility sales teams across the Americas before spells at Netskope and Redlock, who they were then acquired by Palo Alto Networks, where he ran their global cloud security sales team and oversaw their growth from $2 million to $100 million in annual sales. Since 2020, he's been the chief revenue officer of AppOmni, a leading provider of SaaS security management software. And I'm delighted that he's found time in his very busy schedule to join us here in the conference room. So, Brandon Connolly, good afternoon and welcome to the conference room.
Good afternoon. I'm delighted to be on your podcast.
Thank you. Well, every hero has an origin story, and you're the hero of our story. So tell me, how did you get from just starting out to embarking on and then culminating this extraordinary sales and sales leadership career?
Yeah, so I actually started as a headhunter for Unix Solaris systems administrators back in the mid to late 90s, but quickly found that I enjoyed the tech a lot more than I enjoyed the headhunting. So a colleague of mine had left and gone to a client, which was a Kleiner Perkins funded startup called Oblix. They needed somebody to do inside sales on the East Coast. I decided to make the leap from headhunting to working for a Valley startup and never looked back. Spent several years running a territory as an individual contributor in the Mid-Atlantic, focused on global enterprise accounts here. And then was sort of ushered into a management role fairly early in my career, when my direct manager left and they needed somebody to fill that gap. So moved up pretty quickly at Avantail and, again, have never looked back since then.
Wow, that's amazing. So one question that kind of springs to mind when we kind of look at your bio and your history is you've been super successful working for small companies and super successful working for larger companies. What do you see as the primary difference in what it takes to be successful at a smaller company versus what it takes to be successful at, for example, like a Palo Alto?
So I'm biased. I think that people that are successful at startups have a much easier time being successful at a large established company as opposed to the other way around. And I think startup people are sort of a special breed that chooses to be in the infantry. Right, they want a challenge. They're not afraid to fight on the front lines without a lot of support, without a lot of infrastructure behind them, and they take particular pleasure in pulling down very large deals with large enterprise clients. Even though they don't have the brand name recognition, they don't have a deal desk or somebody to complete their RFIs and RFPs, none of that support. And so I think startup people are unique in their ability to tolerate that situation, whereas at a large company, the challenges are more around politics, around bureaucracy, and getting past obstacles and managing up and navigating the bureaucracy than they are about actually selling and closing deals. So I think you can be successful in both, but people that choose to go to startups, I think are suited for that. That's what we want to do.
Right. And do you see that being the same for someone who's an individual contributor as well as somebody who's a leader?
Absolutely. Yeah, no question about it. When we're recruiting at AppOmni or at RedLock or at Zemprise, any of the startups that I've worked for, we look for people that have spent the majority of their careers in small companies for a very specific reason, is that they don't expect all of the support, all of the infrastructure that large company reps have come to expect from their organizations. So yeah, 100%.
Right. Okay. So irrespective of whether we're talking about a large company or a small company, what do you think are the key metrics or the key components that a salesperson needs to have in order to be successful?
I think the best salespeople have a little bit of a chip on their shoulders, right? Something to prove. There's an old joke in sales about, hiring people that have large debts or very expensive lifestyles because they have no choice but to go out and sell to support that lifestyle. I don't take it to that extreme, but I do find that the best reps have a little bit of a chip on their shoulder, something to prove. They want to be recognized. They want to make a difference, and they don't want to be a cog in a big machine, right? They want direct accountability, responsibility when something big happens. And that's hard to get in a large company because there's so many people involved with deals when you work for a large vendor. When you're at a startup, there's no question about who got in, who structured the deal, who closed that deal. It's a much more gratifying feeling.
Yeah. I know from my perspective, being a headhunter working for both large and smaller companies, that the kind of people that join small companies tend to be the ones that want to say or feel that they move the needle. And you could be the best sales guy in the world, but if you go and join Microsoft or IBM or Palo Alto Networks, it's very, very, very hard to move the needle. Whereas if you go and work for a startup or an early stage company, you could really make the difference between a quarter, doing well or not, a year going well or not, getting that round of the next round of funding. A lot of that can really go down to, we wouldn't have got it unless we'd have got the numbers. And what tipped us over the balance was that big deal that guy got. So you can definitely sense that there are people that really want to feel and drive for that recognition, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, no question. I've got so many stories of exactly what you just described. We would not have gotten our B series funding had we not closed XYZ, right? Or made a call to a CISO at the last minute, on December 31st to get a deal across the line. And those are, those are some of the most gratifying moments of my career. And I think it's the same for all individual contributors that are in that situation. It's, at a startup, it's very much a roller coaster. It's an emotional roller coaster. It can be very difficult to deal with the ups and downs, especially if you're only doing a deal or two a quarter, right? Or in some cases, maybe just one or two very large deals in a year. It takes patience and faith, and endurance to see that through. But once you've done it a few times, you get a little more relaxed about it. You know, eventually it's going to come around, right?
No, absolutely. So when we talk about doing one or two deals a quarter or one or two deals a year, how do you manage as a leader or even back, in your days as an individual contributor, how do you manage a pipeline so that at the back end of the quarter, enough deals have come through? Of course, if you have a sales guy that needs to do, say, two deals a quarter in order to make the number, they're not just going to aim for two, are they, right? They're not going to start off the quarter of saying, right, I'm going to sell to these guys and these guys, right? So how do you make sure, what metrics or steps do you put in place to ensure that, irrespective of what happens at the beginning of the quarter and expecting the unexpected that's going to happen during the course of the quarter, that at the end, you're going to get the revenue that you need?
So I believe that there's a large component of chaos in managing a large enterprise pipeline, especially for a startup. In the early days, you simply go after everything that you possibly can, right? And so it's just sheer effort and grit to get into as many accounts as possible and hope that enough of them convert to get to your objectives. And if you've got the right people and you've figured out your ideal customer profile and you've gone after the right partners, right, and you put in the work, made the call, sent the emails, done the LinkedIn emails, attended events, generally that happens if you have a good product. right? But after you have a year or two of experience with that, you start to gather metrics about what your typical conversion rate is over any given period of time. And once you've got that conversion rate, it tends to be relatively stable. Right? Somewhere between 20 and 30% has been my experience of raw pipeline converting to closed one ACV. So then as we get more reps and we're in the 20s of quota carrying sellers and we're worldwide, it becomes more about high level metrics and knowing that year after year, you are successfully converting X percent. And if I've got for me to be comfortable, 5 to 7X raw total pipeline, what I need to get to my ACV target for the year, I have a fairly good level of confidence that we're going to get there. And we don't know which deals it's going to be, right? I'm constantly having this conversation with my CEO and with the board. We'll give you a forecast that is a range. But the beginning of the quarter to the end of the quarter, the actual deals that get us to that number could change dramatically. You just don't know. And that's what I mean by the chaos factor. And it's one of the reasons that I'm not a believer in sales methodologies at all. I mean, a lot of it's just common sense. And I think good reps, track their opportunities. They put in notes, they put in next steps. They know what stage they're at, right? I'm not talking about basic hygiene. The really heavy-handed sales methodologies, they don't help you account for a CISO getting fired 2 weeks before the end of a quarter who had promised you a deal.
Right.
There's so many things that methodologies cannot account for that has to be, I think, just taken into account in that chaos category, right? But if you have enough opportunities in the pipeline that are at mature enough stages, then in spite of the chaos, you're still going to get there. So it's just overweighting on higher probability opportunities and assuming that X percent of them are going to close.
Wow. Right. So effectively just making sure you've got enough of a ratio between raw opportunities at the beginning of the pipeline and what your back end expected quota number is.
It is. And that gets a lot easier as you get larger and the business becomes more transactional. The challenge with a small company, especially if you're very large enterprise focused and the majority of your deals are seven figure ACV transactions, one deal can swing your finish percentage by 50%, right? Yeah. Or 100%. So forecast accuracy is extremely difficult when you've got a small number of opportunities that are very large that are always in effect binary, right? It's either going to happen or it isn't. And if it does happen, we do 125. If it doesn't happen, we come in at 50 or 75%. That's the really stressful part about managing a pipeline in a startup, especially when you're not selling a, product-led growth transactional product for $20,000, $30,000 a year. Yeah. We're talking about, $1 million, $2 million a year contracts. It can be very, very stressful at the end of the quarter because those will make or break your number.
So how do you manage your sales teams to kind of, or the individuals within the sales teams, I should say, to almost kind of harmonize that roller coaster? Are there any sort of methodologies that you put in place to try and mitigate that kind of almost all or nothing binary play?
Well, I encourage everybody to pick up some pheasants on their way to elephant hunting or whatever preferred analogy you have. But depending on the product, it can be just as hard to close a small transaction with an enterprise product as it is to close a large one. So we definitely are biased towards focusing on our ICP and the larger deals. And we are more reactive when it comes to smaller transactional deals. And for that, we rely more on the channel than our direct sales force. So I think the most successful reps are the ones that maximize every route to market. And it's going to be different from geography to geography on what the best routes to market are. But the good reps figure that out and they allocate their time and their energy and their resources appropriately. So everyone's got to have different buckets of pipeline to fall back on in any given quarter.
Right. Okay. One of the joys I find of working within the technology space is there's always something new coming out, okay? And there's and particularly within cybersecurity, which is a world that you and I both operate in. It's fascinating that, however, there's a new sort of emerging threat and then the technology vendors will figure out a way to overcome that threat with new products or a new product line, and eventually a new sector emerges and so on, right? Whereas part of the challenge with that, I would imagine, is to convince your ideal clients, the chief security officers or CISOs or whoever it is, that the product that you have is something that they really need to consider against these emerging threats. So given the fact that you've spent a career in this area, a lot of time in small organizations that are kind of making a name for themselves by selling something that's new and innovative and very often addressing a problem that perhaps a CISO, a chief information security officer, didn't necessarily know they had. How do you go about doing that? How do you convince somebody of a problem or articulate a solution to a problem that they didn't realize that they had?
So I think a lot of that starts with evidence in the market, right? And it's easier when there's a lot of publicly available evidence that a threat is legitimate. And so when I was at RedLock in the cloud security posture management space, we wouldn't have grown at the rate we did had there not been many high profile breaches of S3 buckets in Amazon, right? That really propelled that market forward. There's also a sort of a dynamic there that we had to exploit or leverage, maybe exploit's the wrong word, where
anything, do we?
Take advantage of it. I'm not sure what the best way to describe that is, but something that we identified that was a lever for us to get the attention of the CISO, and that was the shift from on-prem computing to cloud also created a gap between security organizations and the DevOps teams that were building and running workloads in AWS, Azure, and GCP. So this big divide had grown over a period of years where CISOs didn't even have keys to their company's AWS or GCP or Azure environments to even see what was happening, right? Are things configured properly? We have no idea because it's DevOps people who are spinning these things up. DevOps tended to have more power in the organization than security. So, the CISO and team were not empowered to force these DevOps teams to give them access, to give them visibility. And so those two things in combination, public breaches, getting the attention of, CNBC and others, getting press in the Wall Street Journal and other places, and then CISOs recognizing that they had lost power, lost visibility into a very critical component of their organization's compute landscape, that created this opportunity for us to say, hey, Mr. and Mrs. CISO, you have a huge area of risk here that ultimately is your responsibility, but that you have zero visibility or control over. Shouldn't you have at least visibility into what's happening in those environments? And that helped us to get their attention, helped us to get POCs to show that, in fact, they did have, open, unencrypted S3 buckets in their environment and things were badly misconfigured. The same thing is true in the current environment that I'm in at AppOmni. It's the same set of problems, but applied to software as a service, right? The major SaaS platforms. The shared responsibility model exists there, but at the moment, CISOs have little or no visibility into what the sales team is doing with Salesforce or the HR team is doing with Workday, right? And so we have kind of the same story just applied to a different set of applications. And once people see it, especially in security, and they know that a risk exists, they have no option but to do something about it. Mm. So just introducing them to that risk, shining a light in a room that they've never looked in before, is generally enough to get serious engagement. And then we have to prove that the technology works and can be operationalized and it solves a real problem.
Right. Okay. And how do you feel that, particularly in a startup environment where there may not be an awful lot of dollars to spend on marketing, how do you feel that marketing plays a role in that? Particularly if your marketing dollars are very scarce.
So that, I think, comes back to identifying your ideal customer profile and being very deliberate about where you spend those limited marketing dollars, right? So, in our case, and in my case, for most of my career, with the exception of maybe SonicWall, which I was acquired into and had more of a mid-market, SME, SMB focus, with large enterprise, exactly where to go. right? There's organizations like Gartner, Evanta that cater to large enterprise CISOs in different markets, right? There's the GSIs that the largest customers rely on for a lot of their IT and support and security, right? And so we chose to go after those specific routes to market that cater directly to our ICP, and then leverage those relationships to get warm conversations. So I think it's really straightforward. Once you understand who your ideal customer profile is, there are ways to go after them with a limited budget that don't require, you know, air cover type brand marketing, sponsoring ads in the Super Bowl and that sort of thing. You don't need that when all you have to do is go from 0 to 1, from 1 to 3, from 3 to 9 to, you know, 9 to 20. You know, there's enough ways to get to those people, and the deals are large enough that you don't need a huge marketing budget.
Right. Okay. So I want to turn our attention to one of the points that I made in your intro, when we were talking about when you were at Redlock, and then Redlock got acquired by Palo Alto, and this stellar growth from 2 million to 100 million. Now, it may well be that some of that was just down to the fact that you're now part of Palo Alto Networks, but nonetheless, that kind of growth is nothing short of spectacular. Talk me through the story of how you grew a $2 million annual recurring revenue business to one that was over 100 million.
Yeah, so when I started at Redlock, and we were an independent company, we were just under 2 million in ACV. Within the next 10 months, we had gotten to 8 million, just north of 8 million in ACV. So that's,
when we say ACV, that's annual contract value, right?
Yes, exactly. Okay. So you know, that was extremely fast growth for a startup, an independent company the size that we were. We had only taken 12 million in funding before we were acquired by Palo Alto. Had we finished out our fiscal year before getting acquired, we would have done about 12 million. So from 2 to 12.
In a single year?
In a single year.
Wow. Yep. What was it, before we step forward, tell me a little bit about how that was achieved. I mean, to 6x your revenue in a single year is, I mean, even going from, you know, a small number like 2 to a number like 12 is still incredible. How did you go about that? What was that? What did that look
very,
like?
Very similar game plan to AppOmni, which was to go after the largest cloud computing companies in the world, people that were spending the most on CSP services, where we thought there was the lowest hanging fruit. And we successfully closed, you know, multiple seven-figure accounts in that 10-month period. And then the rest of it was kind of more small transactional business, but it wasn't a huge number of customers, right? We're talking right. Sub 100 customers, maybe even sub 50. I don't remember exactly. But there were several that were over seven figures in and of themselves.
Right.
So, you know, that was going incredibly well. We had one day to decide whether or not to take a Series B from a prominent Valley VC when Palo Alto came to the table with a really attractive offer for a company that had only taken 12 million. So we agreed to be acquired. I think in total it was around 215 million when you included RSUs that were part of the deal in addition to the cash. So it was too hard to pass up, I guess. So it's an interesting acquisition because Palo, about a year prior, had acquired our main competitor, a company called Evident.io. Mm. And to a certain extent, Redlock's quick growth and success was at the expense of Evident, which had done well, closed a lot of logos, had a good product, but it was missing some very important capabilities that Redlock used with great success to displace them. And so I think Palo recognized that the CSPM technology had taken a leap from Evident to Redlock, decided to make another acquisition in the same space, bought us. And my first job there was to combine the sales and SE teams of Evident.io that was still at Palo and Redlock. And so that's how we went from, I believe the aggregate revenue between the two companies was somewhere around 20 million in ACV, 25 at most. So really we went from at Palo 25 to closer to 150 million in ACV before I left and joined AppOmni.
Wow. So tell me about that growth. I mean, we're still talking, six times growth again from 25 to 150. So yeah. In a couple of years, to achieve that kind of growth is extraordinary. So talk me through that.
Yeah, so there's a couple of interesting aspects of that. One is people assume that it has to do with Palo's existing sales force and distribution. It had absolutely nothing to do with Palo's existing sales force or distribution. Not that they aren't good, not that their distribution machine isn't amazing. It is. But the core network security firewall teams knew little to nothing about cloud security. My team and the Evident team and the Twistlock team, which became part of Prisma Cloud, we knew little to nothing about network security. Well, that's not true. I was at SonicWall for 5 years, but that was not our domain of expertise. And this is where I give Nikesh Arora, Palo's relatively new CEO at that point, a lot of credit for the way that he approached the building of Prisma Cloud and the acquisitions of RedLock and Twistlock, later PureSec and Aporeto, which were all part of one cloud security business unit, or what we refer to as a speedboat within Palo Alto Networks, right? So you think of the core network security business and next-gen firewalls as an aircraft carrier. It's huge, it has a lot of momentum, but it turns very slowly. Things like Prisma Cloud, and then on the like the SOAR and analytics data lake side of things, Cortex was another speedboat, right? So what he did, I think, was pretty revolutionary. Instead of going after smaller companies that were third or fourth or fifth in their markets, Nikesh chose to acquire what would have been, if there were quadrants for all these things, the upper right-hand quadrant leader in every category.
Right.
So he put together a platform that nobody else could match in terms of capabilities, all the way from the container, all the way up to the EC2 instance in AWS, a single product that could monitor both in real time and out of band the entire cloud stack. I'm sorry, and right. And in doing so, spent quite a bit of money, but has built a business that is now over $500 million in revenue.
Wow. So you think a lot of it was just down to him having kind of the vision to put together a business unit made up of best of breed across the entire market?
The vision and the guts to spend a premium on every one of those acquisitions. And further, beyond just that, a conscious decision to give the sales and SE teams for those acquired companies within the speedboat autonomy and equal footing, equal standing to the core sales teams. So it's not to say that there were never deals that involved both, right? There's certainly some common accounts and we helped each other now and then. But in effect, these companies ran independently. Prisma Cloud ran effectively independently of the network security business, had full autonomy to go out, find and close business. And often it was a totally different buyer, different stakeholder, different budget. And in many cases, we got Palo Alto into accounts that they had never sold a firewall to. And it was a wedge in where, a large enterprise may have made an investment in Checkpoint many years ago. They're not going to throw that out easily and replace it with a Palo or a Fortinet, right?
Right.
But with Prisma Cloud, it was completely new tech. We weren't competing against Checkpoint or Fortinet or anybody else. And so it gave us a wedge into accounts that Palo had never sold to.
Right. That's fascinating. And that was the principal elements that drove this growth from, 2 to 12 at the point when you were acquired by Palo. Almost doubling overnight by bringing in the existing complementary team, and then 6x-ing over the next couple of years.
Yeah, and more so since.
And more so since. That's amazing. Okay. Yeah. So you've had a number of different and evolving job titles throughout your career. And now at Apomni, for the first time, certainly according to your LinkedIn bio, you're now Chief Revenue Officer. There is an old saying in headhunting that you may remember from your early days, that job titles are not job descriptions, okay? But that being said, do you have different, or is there a different set of responsibilities you now have as Chief Revenue Officer that prior to when you were Global VP of Sales, you didn't necessarily have? And what do you feel the principal difference that a CRO has or is to a VP of sales?
The short answer is no. There's no difference in responsibilities. I think that's just a reflection of a trend in the industry. And maybe it's something that companies do now to to be competitive with other startups, right? A XYZ company in this space gets a CRO title. So, you know, if you're hiring somebody to compete with that company and their CRO, you got to hire a CRO yourself. The truth is my responsibilities with respect to building the team, managing it, reporting to the board, they're all pretty much the same as they were at Redlock as VP of Worldwide Sales. I do have some additional responsibilities here now that I didn't have when I joined. It's over 3.5 years now at AppOmni. And when I joined, I didn't have things like customer success, but we have rolled customer success into the same organization that handles pre-sales, right? So we have somebody now on my team that is the chief customer officer and owns that journey all the way from pre-sales, technical support to post-sales customer success and tech support. So that is something new. And I do have all of alliances under my role here at AppOmni, which I don't believe that I had at Redlock. So some minor differences, but really the primary job is the same.
Right. Make sure the sales team is selling stuff and revenue is coming in.
Absolutely.
Pretty much. Okay, great stuff. So when you are hiring, and I know we touched on this a little at the top when we were talking about the differences between sales guys coming from startups versus sales guys coming from corporates. But that aside, okay, when you're hiring for your teams, whether here at AppOmni or prior to, what were the key things that you looked for? And I'm talking beyond the resume. So almost like taken for granted that they were selling in the right domain, they were selling to the right types of customers, that they, you know, they had all the things that when you looked at the resume, you thought this person was worth interviewing. Having then agreed to interview somebody, what were the things you would look for at interview that would determine whether that person was worthy of joining your team?
I think the next most important thing beyond the resume and the companies and the ICP and so forth is culture fit, right? Is this somebody that I like, that I would want to spend time with, right? That I can have a conversation with that isn't purely about business. Are they likable? Because if they're not to me, then they may not be for many customers, right? Or partners or coworkers. And so I always want to build a team that is composed of like-minded individuals who want to be more than just fellow employees and coworkers, but are capable of being, personal friends with the other members of the team. Because we want a collaborative culture. Early on, everyone's learning lessons every day. Those aren't getting captured in a learning management system somewhere, right? They're shared amongst people. And so culture is incredibly important to me. And the second most important thing is, you know, back channel references, right? Is this somebody in a very small industry, right, where everybody knows everybody? Are they connected to a lot of the same people that I am? And if so, what was that person's experience with them? And, you know, it's, you figure out very quickly if it's somebody who, you know, is a, for lack of a better cliche, a rock star, you know, in multiple dimensions, or somebody that just was okay and got by and, you know, is a B player. It doesn't take much. And if I'm not connected to somebody, or one or two connections away from someone, that's a really big flag, because this is not a big industry.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Okay, great stuff. So what would you say are your three tips if somebody wanted to emulate your success in sales leadership?
Wow, you know, this isn't scripted. You didn't give me these questions in advance. That's a tough one. Number one's going to sound cheesy, but it's true. If you don't love technology, if you don't read about cybersecurity because it interests you, whether or not it's your profession, then I wouldn't get into this business, because I think passion is contagious, and prospects and coworkers and everybody you deal with feel it. And if you don't have it, you're not likely to make it very far in this business. The second one is kind of a service mindset, right? Like, I try to help everybody that I can, whether I know them or not, in this industry, because I think it's an incredible industry to be in. In fact, I'm proud to say that at least two of my three kids, one is already in it as a software developer, and the next couple have a very good chance of being in it. So, you know, I really believe in helping people, whether it directly benefits you or not, right? Karma, for lack of a better word. Help everyone you can. It will come back around and pay you back And then the third one is just grit, right? And perseverance. It is very up and down, especially in the startup world. And you just cannot expect to go to every startup and have incredible success, right? The success rate of startups is pretty low. But you know, just because you don't hit a home run on the first one or the second one doesn't mean that the third won't, right? So always keep your head up, stay positive, you know, show that passion and it'll happen.
Right. So tell me about Apomni. Tell me a bit about Apomni, you know, who they are, who they serve, what their value proposition is.
Yeah, we have a cool origin story. Our CEO and co-founder, Brendan O'Connor, was the first product security hire at Salesforce back in 2007. He was there for 10 years, so you know, full decade. The back half of that, he was the CISO, Chief Trust Officer at Salesforce. Many of the people that founded the company have come from SaaS vendors like ServiceNow and Slack and others. They're also investors in the company, Salesforce and ServiceNow and Cisco. So, you know, started with Brendan, who had a great network in the Valley, helped us, you know, win our first handful of customers and establish kind of our ICP. And then he brought with him the conviction that SaaS security was a huge gap that nobody was adequately solving with existing technologies like CASB and SSE or SASE. And he brought a point of view, having run product security at the, you know, one of the largest SaaS companies in the world, that there was a major gap. Because every SaaS platform is unique and it's a snowflake in terms of how it handles security. And that there's a misunderstanding in the market that SaaS comes, you know, secure out of the box and you never have to look at it again. The truth is that there's a shared responsibility model and many companies are not aware of what their responsibilities are in managing security in SaaS. And so, we've gone to almost 200 employees. We were founded 5 years ago. We've been shipping a product a little under 4 years. And, triple, double, looking to double again.
Great. So that's amazing. So what's next for you and for Apomni?
Well, I'm looking forward to being back in the NASDAQ. I was there on Monday helping to ring the closing bell as part of the Redpoint Ventures Infrared 100, which we are honored to be a part of. And I expect to be back there in a couple of years ringing the closing bell to celebrate our IPO.
Wow. Well, good luck with that. That's amazing. So if people wanted to get in touch with you or connect with you, what's the best way for them to do that?
LinkedIn.
Okay, I'll make sure your LinkedIn profile is in the show notes below. Brandon, thank you so much for joining us on the conference room. It's been an amazing, amazing conversation. I've learned so much and it's been fascinating to talk about sales leadership, pipeline management. We've covered an awful lot in a relatively short period of time. So I'm super, super grateful for your time and for coming in. So Brandon Conley, thank you so much for joining us here in the conference room.
Thank you, Simon. It's been a pleasure.
Coming up next week on the conference room, I'll be talking to the CEO of Plurilock, Ian Patterson.
I think CEOs and founders are usually pretty good generalists. So that's the first part. You're just dangerous enough to know how much you don't know about a lot of individual functions. And then you supplement that with people, ideally, who are smarter and more experienced than you are.
Thanks so much for listening. We really appreciate it. And make sure you visit our website, theconferenceroompodcast.com, to see all the other episodes and to get access to the show notes and resources mentioned in this episode. If you enjoyed the episode, please share it with your network, or better still, go on to Apple Podcasts or Spotify or any other podcast platform and leave us a 5-star review. It'll only take you a moment, but it'll mean the world to us. And please don't hesitate to tell us which topics you'd like us to cover in future episodes. To get in touch, drop us a line in the comments section or send us a message on social media. Just search for The Conference Room Podcast or me, Simon Lader, on Facebook, LinkedIn, Instagram, or TikTok. I'm always open to a conversation. And don't forget to hit that subscribe button so you'll be alerted when a new episode goes live every week. Thanks so much for listening to The Conference Room, and until next time, keep talking.